talks in Saudi Arabia on the Ukraine war, saying meeting is intended to forge an anti-Russia coalition. U.S. stocks take a plunge after the Fitch Ratings Agency downgrades the country's credit rating over fiscal deterioration and the government's rising debt. And the U.S. says more than 20 million people are experiencing high levels of acute food insecurity in Sudan. Hello, everybody, and thanks for tuning in to World News. In our top story, Russia has censured upcoming peace talks on the Ukraine war to be held in Saudi Arabia. Moscow says meeting serves to form a coalition against the Kremlin. Now, U.S. stocks have taken a nosedive after the Fitch Ratings Agency downgrades the country's credit rating by a notch down from AAA to AA. Now, on Wednesday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average shed about 350 points, or 1%, while the broad-based S&P 500 dropped 1.4%. The tech-rich NASDAQ Composite Index tumbled 2.2%. Fitch attributes the U.S. credit rating downgrade to expected fiscal deterioration over the next 3 years and the government's growing debt. This is the second time a major ratings agency has lowered the U.S. rating after the S&P made a similar move in 2011. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has criticized the downgrade, calling it entirely unwarranted. She claims Fitch has ignored improvements in governance metrics under the Biden administration and the country's economic strength. And earlier we were joined by Paul Sheldon Foote, economics professor out of Southern California, and he believes the state of the U.S. economy is far worse than what the American rating agency Fitch has portrayed.
Fitch just covered some of the big negatives. They could have covered far more. I mean, for example, they pointed out that the debt keeps growing, the interest on that debt keeps growing, and to make the interest payments, you've got to print more money to make the interest payments. We have an aging population, of which I'm a good example. So you have rising amounts of Medicare and Social Security costs for which there is not enough money available. You have the Federal Reserve Bank raising interest rates in a desperate attempt to bring inflation down. You have other countries of the world dumping the dollar and no longer using it. For a long time, America was able to get away with this irresponsible behavior because Communist China and some other countries would hold huge amounts of our debt. Well, they were financing us. It's like giving drugs to an addict. They were financing us, they shouldn't have been. Now that means that if the government needs to raise money, they're going to have to try to convince investors to invest more in treasury securities, which means higher interest rates to attract people to invest.
The United Nations has warned millions of people are on the brink of famine in Sudan as hunger and displacement are spiraling out of control in the African country. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization says more than 20 million people throughout Sudan are facing high levels of acute food insecurity between July and September this year. According to the UN agency, 14 million Sudanese are experiencing a food crisis, and more than 6 million are now just one step from famine. The report attributes this alarming situation to the ongoing armed conflict, which is coupled with subsequent economic downturn and mass displacement. According to International Organization for Migration, more than 3 million people have been internally displaced since start of the conflict. UN World Food Program has also warned more than 19 million Sudanese are facing food insecurity. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned against an Israeli plan to build a Jewish temple on the ruins of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Hamas spokesman Abdul Latif Al-Kanu condemned such plan and called it an extremely dangerous and unprecedented escalation in the religious war waged against Palestinians. Based on the statement, Zionist groups with backing of far-right Israeli regime are hastily trying to change the religious, historical, and legal status quo of the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Al-Quds. Hamas has urged Muslims worldwide to help protect Islam's third holiest site in the face of Israeli desecration. Non-Muslims are allowed to visit the mosque compound, but they, including Jews, are prohibited from engaging in religious activities there. But Israeli settlers often storm the mosque compound under protection of regime forces. A leading Muslim organization in the UK warns of the government's discriminatory policies, insisting British banks target Muslims in the country. The Muslim Council of Britain says UK is discriminating against British Muslims by disproportionately denying them banking services. So-called British debanking problem has been under spotlight in recent weeks after former Independent Party leader Nigel Farage had his account closed by the courts.
Muslims in the United Kingdom have criticized the country's banking system over its discriminatory policies towards them. Campaigners say British Muslims have been disproportionately denied banking services. They say the bank accounts of British Muslims have been closed without adequate transparency and recourse. The Muslim Council of Britain has written to the Prime Minister, Chancellor of the Exchequer, leaders of opposition parties, and the Permanent Secretary to the Treasury, expressing deep concerns over the arbitrary closure of bank accounts belonging to Muslim individuals and Muslim organizations. In the letter, the MCB highlights the recurring issue of banks withdrawing services from British Muslims over the past decade without adequate transparency and recourse for those affected. The MCB said, "We urge for an impartial review that not only addresses the mechanisms behind bank account closures, but also examines why British Muslims are disproportionately affected by this issue." The letter also says successive governments have ignored the issue of banks withdrawing services from British Muslims, and the practice had persisted without adequate transparency and recourse for those affected. The MCB's intervention comes after figures from Britain's Financial Conduct Authority named Muslims as the only faith group likely to be unbanked in Britain. The criticism comes amid the backdrop of a controversy which erupted after a prestigious bank in the UK closed the account of right-wing politician Nigel Farage. He's the former leader of the UK Independence Party, a right-wing political party that campaigned to take Britain out of the European Union. Farage's bank account was shut down by Coutts, owned by NatWest Group, over the alleged disagreements in political views. The boss of NatWest Group has apologized for the bank closure. Following the incident, the government announced plans to force banks to explain account closures. Farage had put in a request to the bank to see documents relating to the decision to close its Coutts account.
See, what I said right at the start of this, that it was right for people to be deprived of basic services like banking because of their views. Now, ultimately, this isn't about any one individual, it's about values. Do you believe in free speech and not to be discriminated against because of your legally held views?
Critics say the apology and explanation offered to Farage highlights the double standards toward Muslims in the UK. While Farage received the 40-page report regarding the closure of his account, many Muslim charities say they have not received the same explanation. Muslim charities have been facing bank closures for over two decades and are often over-policed by banks and their policies.
My conclusion is there can really only be one answer. It was Muslims, British Muslims for the most part, who were having their bank accounts removed. And of course, British Muslims don't count. Whereas when Nigel Farage has his bank account removed, that's headlines in the mainstream media and cue a wave of sycophantic, sob-story columnists coming into action to say, poor Nigel.
According to UK's Financial Conduct Authority, Muslims are the only faith group likely to be unbanked across Britain. Many leading British Muslim civil society activists and charities have had their bank accounts closed for years with little or no explanation. Critics have highlighted the contrast between the furor over Farage's account closure with lack of interest in cases involving Muslim and pro-Palestine organizations.
In recent weeks, Muslim faith-based charities and pro-Palestine solidarity groups have highlighted that they have been subject to bank closures for years as a result of their political views and a major backlash from politicians or the press. HSBC closed the account of Finsbury Park Mosque, and other banks refused to take the mosque custom, despite no law having been broken. Islamic Relief, one of the largest and most long-standing Muslim charities, was also debanked by HSBC. In 2015, the Palestine Solidarity Campaign had its bank account with a cooperative bank closed. Palestine Solidarity Campaign is the UK's most prominent pro-Palestinian organization.
And I have people who wept describing the humiliation of it and the consequences for their own families. I've spoken to people whose charities have been wiped out. Palestinian Solidarity Campaign, the Finsbury Park Mosque, very respectable organisation in Islington, North London. The mainstream media totally ignored the story. I often press journalists, friends of mine in the media, please run something about it.
Reports now say the political turbulence plaguing the UK Conservative Party over the last 2 years has slowed its internal efforts to tackle Islamophobia. The study led by Swaran Singh, a former Equality and Human Rights Commissioner, has found evidence of discrimination and anti-Muslim views at local association and individual levels.
Iran and Pakistan's foreign ministers have held talks in Islamabad with a focus on the expansion of economic cooperation and trade. In a meeting, Hossein Amir Abdullahian said the two countries have already signed many cooperation agreements. The Iranian minister said that he was in Pakistan to push for implementation of those deals and promote long-term cooperation. He said two governments have made good deals on boosting security along their shared border, which could help pave the way for further expansion of ties. Meanwhile, the Pakistani Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari expressed satisfaction that bilateral trades increased by 50% in recent years, but he said there's still opportunity for an expansion of cooperation and Islamabad is eager to see closer ties with Tehran. At the end of their meeting, two delegations signed a five-year trade cooperation plan. Lebanon's Central Bank Governor Riyad Salameh says he will step down after 30 years in office in light of dire economic crisis. Mariam Saleh has your story.
Leaving Lebanon's economy with an almost total economic meltdown, Riyad Salameh has stepped down as governor of the central bank. The central bank's newly appointed acting governor, Wasim Mansouri, on Monday called on the government to implement a capital control law, a financial restructuring law, and a 2023 state budget within 6 months.
We were able to convince the government that the subsidies policy needs to stop, and as a result, management improved and the economy relatively began to recover. However, the government's need for the U.S. dollar continues, since the only way to government's reliance on the central bank was to improve public finances. The problem is not monetary, and the solution is not with the central bank. The main issue is in the financial policies of the state, and there needs to be a clear decision to improve general management.
He stressed that the bank would impose restrictions on when to lend money to the government. Salameh was for years credited for economic recovery following Lebanon's civil war. Yet now he is being investigated by at least seven countries, including Lebanon, for embezzlement and illicit enrichment. He denies the accusations. A former advisor to three central bank governors in Lebanon tells that Salameh was merely following the U.S. policies.
He was implementing the U.S. policies, and U.S. policies since the end of World War II stipulated that the countries of the Third World are prohibited from development. They only allowed Korea and Taiwan to prosper since they want to confront China and Russia, but they also supported Israel in this region and even prevented Egypt from becoming an industrial nation.
The problem, he believes, is a problem of mismanagement as well as in the structure of the policies, which bound the Lebanese lira to the U.S. dollar.
He pegged the price of the Lebanese lira to the U.S., saying that this would stabilize the lira, but this was a catastrophic mistake, which I had warned against. The U.S. dollar itself is not stable, so pegging the lira to the U.S. dollar won't make it stable. We needed to peg our currency to a basket of currencies based on imports to Lebanon. This impacted its ability to compete in the global markets.
The current financial crisis began in 2019. The value of the Lebanese lira plummeted and inflation soared in the Arab country. After 30 years in his post, Lebanon's former central bank governor is seen by many experts as being the main orchestrator of the financial and monetary policies, which led to an abrupt collapse. However, there are also speculations that he couldn't have done it without collaboration from the country's political elite. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Now, Typhoon Hanun continues to wreak havoc in Japan with intense rain and fierce winds leading to more potential storm damage. Two people have been confirmed dead and more than 40 others injured in Okinawa and Kagoshima prefectures. Some 166,000 households are said to be without electricity. The Naha Airport in Okinawa has resumed operations after a shutdown 2 days ago. However, hundreds of flights are still canceled in southern Japan. Storm in the East China Sea is now changing course from the northwest to the east toward the country's mainland. Its actual path has yet to be determined. Earlier, Typhoon Hanun also forced schools and businesses to shutter in Taiwan. That, as China is still reeling from deadly floods due to its heaviest rains in over 140 years. And that's a wrap for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us, and goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Former President Donald Trump's team is launching a legal defense fund aimed at helping to handle the onslaught of legal bills the former president and his allies face as the investigations into him mount. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Donald Trump allies, led by longtime Trump advisor Michael Glassner, are creating a new legal defense fund, according to a person with direct knowledge of the plans. The group will be called the Patriot Legal Defense Fund, Inc., and its focus will be on paying legal bills, not for Donald Trump and his family, but for Trump's allies and staffers. The group's creation comes as the former president and some of his associates are embroiled in multiple criminal investigations and cases. The group is not part of the Trump 2024 campaign and is separate from Trump's leadership PAC, Save America, which has already spent over $40 million on legal fees for Trump and associates so far this year. Save America doesn't offer a breakdown of how much has been spent on any individual or which investigations are involved. Earlier this year, the Trump campaign noted, in fine print, that it was increasing the percentage of supporters' donations it sent to Trump's Save America PAC from 1% to 10%, as the New York Times first reported in June, a signal of how expensive Trump world expects these legal fights to be. The president's sprawling legal landscape entails charges in an alleged hush money scheme in New York and criminal charges over his handling of classified documents at Mar-a-Lago. Donald Trump has pleaded not guilty in both cases. The former president could also be facing more indictments. He said on social media earlier in July that he received a target letter from Special Counsel Jack Smith relating to the 6th of January 2021 investigation and alleged efforts to overturn the 2020 election results, a claim confirmed by multiple sources. Also in Fulton County, Georgia, a grand jury may soon consider whether Trump, his associates, and so-called fake electors were allegedly sought to reverse the state's Electoral College vote, should be charged over alleged attempts to interfere with the peaceful transfer of power after the 2020 presidential election. The former president insists he's innocent in all of the investigations and cases, casting blame on state and federal prosecutors as politically motivated. Michael Glasner was the chief strategist for Donald Trump's 2020 presidential campaign and deputy campaign manager for Trump's 2016 presidential campaign. National broadcaster ABC News has also covered the same story. Former President Donald Trump's team is launching a legal defense fund aimed at helping to handle the onslaught of legal bills the former president and his allies face as the investigations into him mount. Sources familiar with the matter have confirmed to ABC News. On Monday, 31st of July, Save America PAC reported in its latest disclosure report to the Federal Election Commission more than $21.6 million in legal spending to defend Donald Trump, his advisers, and others in the first half of 2023. For now, the legal fund is not meant to cover Donald Trump's own bills, the sources said. The legal defense fund will be called the Patriot Legal Defense Fund, Inc., according to sources. It is expected to be led by Michael Glasner, who has previously served in multiple senior roles on Donald Trump's 2016 and 2020 presidential campaigns. Lynn Patton, who has been a close aide to Donald Trump at both the Trump Organization and in Trump's administration, will also be involved in the fund. A Trump spokesperson provided a statement about the reasons for the defense fund. To protect these innocent people from financial ruin and prevent their lives from being completely destroyed, a new legal defense fund will help pay for their legal fees to ensure they have representation against unlawful harassment, the statement read. News of the new pact was first reported by the New York Times. Mounting legal costs come as Donald Trump faces mounting legal troubles, including a superseding indictment handed up last week by a federal grand jury in a special counsel Jack Smith's investigation into Trump's handling of classified documents after leaving office. The superseding indictment charges Donald Trump and two others, Carlos de Oliveira, head of maintenance at Mar-a-Lago's estate, and Trump aide Walt Nota, with two obstruction counts based on allegations that the defendants attempted to delete surveillance video footage at Mar-a-Lago in the summer of 2022. In June, Donald Trump pleaded not guilty to 37 criminal counts relating to his handling of classified materials, after prosecutors said he repeatedly refused to return hundreds of documents containing classified information, ranging from U.S. nuclear secrets to the nation's defense capabilities. Donald Trump has denied all charges and denounced the probe as a political witch hunt. Walt Nota, who was also previously charged, also pleaded not guilty. Neither of them has pleaded to the new charges as yet. Carlos de Oliveira is set to appear in court on Monday. Donald Trump separately faces a 34-count indictment in New York State Court relating to hush money paid to the actress Stormy Daniels before the 2016 election. He has pleaded not guilty in that case. U.S. newspaper The Seattle Times has also covered the same story. Former President Donald Trump's team is creating a legal defense fund to handle some of the crush of legal bills stemming from the investigations and criminal indictments involving him and a number of employees and associates, according to two people with knowledge of the matter. The fund, which is expected to be called the Patriot Legal Defense Fund, Inc., will be led by Michael Glassner, a longtime Trump political advisor, according to people familiar with the planning. Another Trump aide who worked at the Trump Organization and then in Trump administration, Lynn Patton, will also be involved. It is unclear how broad a group of people the Legal Defense Fund will cover, but one person said it was not expected to cover Donald Trump's own legal bills. In recent months, Trump's Political Action Committee has paid legal bills for him and several witnesses, spending more than $40 million on lawyers in the first half of 2023. But a wide swathe of people have become entangled in the various Trump-related criminal investigations, both as witnesses, of whom there are many who work for Donald Trump personally or did in the White House, as well as defendants. Trump spokesperson Stephen Chung said the Justice Department had targeted innocent Americans associated with President Trump and that to combat these heinous actions and protect these innocent individuals from financial ruin and prevent their lives from being completely destroyed, a new legal defense fund will help pay for their legal fees to ensure they have representation against unlawful harassment. Donald Trump's Political Action Committee, Save America, has been a focus of one of the investigations by special counsel Jack Smith, who has had at least two grand juries looking at Trump and his allies and advisors. Jack Smith's team has questioned why some lawyers for specific witnesses are being paid, as well as whether aides to Donald Trump and Republicans knew Trump had lost the election but continued to raise money from his debunked claims.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
Brothers and sisters, our topic that we are exploring on these evenings is the enlightened journey, the path of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. The person I would like to speak about for a bit on this evening is somebody by the name of Usama ibn Zayd. Usama is somebody you probably are familiar with from Islamic history. You know that Zayd ibn Thabit was the adopted son of the Prophet. Of course, you know, in Islam, There's no place for adoption in the sense of somebody becoming like a full family member. But there is the tradition of taking care of orphans. And in the case of Zayd, he had a special relationship with our Prophet. He lived with the Prophet. And our Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam used to have a lot of love for him, and he would praise him openly. Now, he had a son by the name of Usama. And maybe because Zayd was special to the Prophet, his son Usama was also special to the Prophet. We're told, for example, that Zayd was just a child, maybe 8 years old, after the Battle of Badr, when our Prophet wanted to go and visit and make an official visit, he put Zayd on his own saddle and he rode with him. And this is a mark of honor, it's a mark of respect. And later we see that Zayd is somebody who is, even though he's young, he shows military prowess. He's able to fight battles of men despite being just a young man at that time. And we know that in the last days of our beloved Prophet's life in this world, one of the concerns that Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam had was regarding the succession. He wanted to solidify the position of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam as the wali, as the one who is in charge. One of the ways he did so was to command the Muslims to leave the city and to engage in battle with the Romans. And the army he ordered should be under the leadership of Usama ibn Zayd. Usama at that time was approximately 18 years old. Now imagine that, for example, in a gathering of hundreds or thousands of men, an 18-year-old is chosen to be the leader. Even right now, we would think to ourselves that, well, isn't that person a little bit unexperienced, right? Maybe we need to go with somebody who's a little bit like, a veteran, right, has seen different things. One of the reasons why our Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam did that is to break some of those customs that had settled in and that had been there actually from the time of Jahiliyyah, and there was a fear of them returning. One of those customs was that by default, de facto, the one who is the older is the one who is more suitable for leadership. There were those who, as the Prophet was getting sick and they saw that now there would be a new leader, they were starting to revive the customs of the Jahiliyyah. And they said that, okay, well, leadership should be in hands of the elder. The Prophet says, no, I am appointing for you a young man. One of the other things the Prophet wants to show is the potential that the youth have. And this is extremely important, that when we look at our youth, sometimes we can see the greenness, right? We can see that, oh, this person is inexperienced, right? We can see how maybe they make mistakes at times. And sometimes, as caregivers, as older brothers, as parents, we can make it a big deal, right? To focus on those areas where they fall short, not realizing the immense potential that they have. And so one of the things our Prophet shows us is that Usama is somebody who is a young man, but he has potential. And we know that, according to history, despite the command of the Prophet, despite his getting angry when he realized that the Muslims were not following that command, the army of Usama ibn Zayd never left the city and never was able to really dispatch and go towards the Romans. With all the efforts, they started and they failed. Now anyhow, once our beloved Prophet leaves this world and he departs from this world, Usama ibn Zayd is somebody who is a known figure. He's somebody who has prestige. He was the one who they used to see riding next to the Prophet on his own saddle. He's the one who was appointed as the commander of the army. What he does, what he says, people take note of that. He is one of the elite. But history tells us that when it came time for Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi salam to become the Khalifa of the Muslims, Usama ibn Zayd refuses to give him the bay'ah. He does not give him allegiance. Now what happened? Right? One of the things that's recorded in history is that Usama, because of his status, the previous Khulafa, they used to give him a special handout, a special stipend from the treasury. And so when Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam comes into power, Usama writes him a letter. He says that, you know what kind of person I am. I'm ready to leap into the mouth of a lion to show my bravery and support you. But right now, I'm asking you for some money. And so please, the same way I was used to get money from the treasury, I need that money. What does Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam respond to him? He says to him, just the gist of it is that, Usama, this money is not mine to give. I'm not like the previous Khulafa. I'm not going to do things that way. I have some personal funds in Medina. You can have access to those however much you want, but you're not going to get any amount of the treasury. Maybe this is one of the factors that influences him. Anyhow, the time comes for war. We know that with the succession of Imam Ali alayhi salam, civil war took place for the first time among the Muslims. And Imam Ali alayhi salam summons the warrior, the man who was chosen as the commander of the army, somebody who was famous. He says, now it's your time. Right? You're there. It's time for you to come and to participate in this battle. What does Usama do at this point when he's tested? This is very important. He tells him that, I love you. You're very dear to me, O Ali ibn Abi Talib. In fact, you're the most dear of all of creation to me. This is what he says. But I have made a pledge that I will not fight with the people of La ilaha illallah. So therefore, I'm not going to be able to join you in this battle. Now, what is the thinking of Usama ibn Zayd? This is important, and I'm going into these details because we're trying to understand the thought pattern here. Why did he make this statement? It goes back to an incident that took place during his lifetime where he was participating in a battle. He had his spear ready to go, and there was a man who he was charging at from the army of the disbelievers. And that man, when he saw that he was for sure going to be taken down by Usama's spear, he starts to say, La ilaha illallah. So this time, he's ready with the spear. He knows that that man realizes that basically it's over. And he thinks to himself, okay, at this point, he can't be sincere. I have to go ahead with this. And he launches that spear. Our beloved Prophet finds out about this. And he questions Usama ibn Zayd about what he had done. He asks him, oh Usama, did you kill somebody who professed to the unity of God, somebody who took the shahada of La ilaha illallah? Usama says that he did it, just wanted to save his life. It wasn't something that was real. And what does our Prophet say? Very gently. He wants to teach him. He says, oh Usama, perhaps you opened up his heart to see the reality of what he was saying. And that's how you came to know this? The Prophet wanted to teach him that this was not the case where he should just make a rash judgment and assume that that person was saying this out of hypocrisy, out of lying. It wasn't his position to actually kill him. Now, what was our Prophet telling him at that time? And what did Usama understand? Our Prophet was telling him that when you do things on the basis of principle. Don't act out of pure emotion. Your responsibility is more than that. I have higher expectations from you, O Usama. But how did he understand this? He understood it to say that the Prophet had made him a specific command for him and him only, that whenever there is a war, if it's a war of Muslims against Muslims, his responsibility is to be quiet and to just sit at home and to be passive and to not cast any judgment on that. It's a position of neutrality. A position of not taking a position.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Kareem Adi Alim Hakim.
قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Julian Assange's supporters in the Australian Parliament have asked the US government to get him the hell out of a maximum security prison in London, regardless of diplomatic friction over the WikiLeaks founder's eventual fate. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Associated Press news agency has covered this story and tells us more. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has pushed back at the Australian government's calls to end the pursuit of Julian Assange, insisting that the WikiLeaks founder is alleged to have risked very serious harm to our national security. After high-level talks in Brisbane, largely focused on military cooperation, Antony Blinken confirmed that the Australian government had raised the case with the United States on multiple occasions and claimed he understood the concerns and views of Australians. But he pointedly added that it was very important that our friends here in Australia understood the US concerns about Assange's alleged role in one of the largest compromises of classified information in the history of our country. The key announcements after the meeting on Saturday, 29th of July, included that the US would increase the tempo of visits of nuclear-powered submarines to Australia. The United States also plans to step up rotations of maritime patrol and reconnaissance aircraft and introduce new rotations of US Army watercraft, while pledging to help Australia to start domestic manufacturing of missiles within 2 years. The US assured the Australian government about the attempts to secure congressional support for the AUKUS deal remained on track, even as some Republicans pushed for greater funding for US production. But Antony Blinken's defense of the US allegations against Julian Assange will be seen as a blow to the campaign to free the Australian citizen. Julian Assange remains in Belmarsh Prison in London as he fights a US attempt to extradite him to face accusations in connection with the publication of hundreds of thousands of leaked documents about the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, as well as diplomatic cables. The Australian Foreign Affairs Minister Penny Wong confirmed she had raised the case of Julian Assange with the US government. At a joint press conference alongside Antony Blinken, Penny Wong said, "We have made clear our view that Assange's case has dragged for far too long, and our desire that it be brought to a conclusion, and we've said that publicly, and you would anticipate that that reflects also the position that we articulate in private." However, the Australian Foreign Affairs Minister Penny Wong added that there were limits to what could be achieved in talks between governments until Assange processes have concluded. Antony Blinken, speaking second, told reporters that as a general matter of policy, the US did not comment on extradition proceedings. He said, "The US Department of Justice has indicated that Assange was charged with very serious criminal conduct, Anthony Blinken claimed. The actions that he has alleged to have committed risk very serious harm to our national security, to the benefits of our adversaries, and put named human sources at grave risk of physical harm, and grave risk of detention. Blinken added, "So I say that only because, just as we understand sensitivities here, it's important that our friends understand sensitivities in the United States." Julian Assange's brother, Gabriel Shipton, said it was now up to the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, to put Australians' views in front of the President himself during a forthcoming visit to the United States. Assange's brother, Gabriel Shipton, said Secretary of State Anthony Blinken's snub to Australians demanding Julian's freedom cuts deeper, knowing the American, who alleged leaked the information, has been free since 2017. The former US military analyst Chelsea Manning's sentence was commuted by the Obama administration in 2017. An advisor to the Australian Assange campaign, Greg Barnes, also responded to Anthony Blinken's comments. Greg Barnes said Blinken needs to understand the overwhelming view of Australians, which is that enough is enough. Julian Assange must be released immediately and be able to rejoin his family. Australian federal politicians from across the political spectrum wrote to the US Attorney General Merrick Garland back in April to argue the case set a dangerous precedent for press freedom and would damage the reputation of the United States. The 48 MPs and senators, including 13 from the governing Labour Party, said the accusations, which include 17 counts under the Espionage Act and one count under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, pertain to Julian Assange's actions as a journalist and publisher in publishing information with evidence of war crimes, corruption, and human rights abuses. The Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance has argued the prosecution of Julian Assange imperils journalism everywhere and undermines the United States' reputation as a so-called safe place for press freedom. British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. US Secretary of State Anthony Blinken and the Australian Foreign Affairs Minister Penny Wong were joined by US Defence Secretary Lloyd Austin and the Australian Defence Minister Richard Marles for annual talks in Brisbane known as AUSMIN. As dozens of Republicans in the US Senate flexed their muscle on AUKUS legislation on Capitol Hill demanding extra funds to boost US domestic production, the Australian Defence Minister Richard Marles said he and Penny Wong were both legislators and very much understand the heat and light that comes with the passage of legislation. Richard Marles said, "We're absolutely assured by Tony and Lloyd, but also, in fact, by the efforts that we've undertaken ourselves in speaking with those on the Capitol Hill, that there is a bipartisan commitment to Australia acquiring the capability to operate nuclear-powered submarines." Lloyd Austin defended the adequacy of the US level of investment into its own submarine production, but did not rule out considering an increase in funds. "We will continue to make sure that all pieces are in place as we proceed," he said. The US had committed to help Australia produce guided missile launch rocket systems, or GMLRS, by 2025. Meanwhile, Julian Assange's supporters in the Australian Parliament have asked the US government to get him the hell out of a maximum security prison, regardless of diplomatic friction over the WikiLeaks founder's eventual fate. The Australian citizen remains in Belmarsh Prison in London as he fights a US attempt to extradite him to face charges in connection with the publication of hundreds of thousands of leaked documents about the Afghanistan and Iraq wars, as well as diplomatic cables. Labour MP Julian Hill, a member of the Bring Julian Assange Home parliamentary group, said he had a fundamentally different view of the substance of the matter than Secretary Antony Blinken expressed. Julian Hill said on Monday, 31st of July, in the same vein, I would say, back to the United States, at the very least, take Julian Assange's health issues seriously, and going to court in the United Kingdom and get him the hell out of a maximum security prison where he's at risk of dying without medical care if he has another stroke. Labour MP Julian Hill, who said recently no one would think less of Julian Assange if he struck a plea deal, added that improving the prison conditions should not be difficult to do, even while argument continues about resolution of this matter.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The viewpoints of the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the tragedy of Karbala. On the day of Ashura, Zainab al-Kubra watched many of her dear ones go to the battlefield to get martyred. She watched Hussein ibn Ali, Abbas, Ali al-Akbar, Qasim, her children, and other dear ones go to the battlefield. After they were martyred, she went through all those pains. The invasion of the enemy, disrespect, and the responsibility to take care of the surviving children and women. Is it possible to compare the enormity of this tragedy with physical pain? But when she was faced with these difficulties, Zainab al-Kubra did not tell God to save her. She did not say, "Oh my Lord, save me." On the day of Ashura, she said, "O God, accept this from us." While she shredded body of her brother lay in front of her eyes, tells God, "O God, accept this sacrifice from us." When she was asked to describe what she had seen, she replied, "I did not see anything but beauty."
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana latsham.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
All those tragedies were beautiful to Zainab al-Kubra because they were from and for God, because they were supposed to promote the word of God. See how different this position, this patience, and this love of justice and truth are compared to Asiya's position described in the Holy Quran. This shows the greatness of Zainab's position. This is the nature of actions that are carried out for the sake of God. Therefore, Zainab's actions are currently a model, and her name and achievements will remain until the end of time. The permanence of Islam and the divine path and continuation of this path by God's servants are based on what Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and Zainab al-Kubra did. That is to say, as a result of the great patience, resistance, and endurance of hardships, you see that religious values have gained a lot of ground in the modern world. All these human values, which are consistent with human nature in different schools of thoughts, are rooted in religious values. These values have been promoted by religion. That is the nature of efforts for a divine cause.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.